So from the perspective of everything that we've shared in this program, what we can say is literally that we speak to the world around us. We speak the language of creation in a nonverbal experience that we call feeling. And I know that you don't have to hear my voice in this program to understand that. We experience this every day in our lives. We experience it in ways sometimes that we would never understand. We experience it perhaps in ways that we would never expect. And nonetheless, these are very real experiences in our lives. And sometimes they're just anecdotal kinds of experiences that help us understand this. There are other effects, other ways of knowing about the power of human emotion in our physical world. We speak to the web of creation using the language of our heart. That is the language that we call feeling. We are feeling feelings all the time. You know it from your own experience. What happens to you Friday afternoon when I was in the corporate world? This is what we used to do. We used to get the old-fashioned paychecks where they'd give you a physical paycheck, not the electronic deposits. Friday afternoon, we get a paycheck. A few of us would get together. We'd run to the bank, cash our check, go get a bite to eat, run a few errands, be back to work in 45 minutes. Right? Every time. Right. When you flat have to get somewhere because you're in a hurry, what happens? When we absolutely have to get through that bank in less than 5 minutes, what teller line do we get behind every time without fail? And you know this. It happens every time. You get behind a teller line where a man or a woman has not balanced that checkbook for 25 years and is asking the teller for some insight into why their checks are bouncing all over the place. Or when you flat out have to be somewhere, what line of traffic are you going to get into? We live approximately 4 hours away from the Albuquerque airport in the mountains of northern New Mexico. I can drive 6 hours to DIA or 4 hours to the Albuquerque airport when I leave my property. And there are a lot of things that can happen in those 4 hours. If I leave and I say, I've got to get here to catch this plane because I've got to be in San Diego at a certain time, I'm coming out of that canyon. There's only one lane each direction. What's going to happen? A slow truck that is hauling a 1951 Chevy short bed pickup with no engine that's been sitting in the guy's yard for 30 years. And he waits that day to hook it up on a chain and tow it down the canyon. And I can't do anything until we're out of the canyon. You know these things happen. What quantum science is doing is that they're quantifying what this means in our lives and how it works in our world. We've already had some of this discussion. Let me ask you this question, though. With what we've done here so far, how does it change the way you view your world? Or does it at all? What does it mean in your world on a personal or on a global level? There is a field of energy that bathes all of creation. It permeates every aspect of our creation. It has been with us since the beginning of time, apparently. It's always everywhere, all the time. It has an intelligence that responds to human emotion. What does that mean to you? We have options. We have options in terms of the way we live our lives. We know this. Does it change your life? Does it make a difference personally or globally? Let me ask this. Are you seeing people around you suffering and with more illness and disease than it seems like we have in the past? Does it seem like that's happening to you? Does it feel like the peace of our world is on a really rocky precipice right now? Do you feel like you're just waiting to see what's going to happen? Or do you feel like you're a part of what's happening and you're looking for ways to participate? Because if you are, this is what this field is saying to us. We know from these kind of mundane, insignificant experiences, what seem insignificant to us, the world around us is mirroring the thoughts, the feelings, the expectations that we have in our heart, that we're carrying in our beliefs. From this perspective, not only do we speak a language into the creation of the world around us, into the mind of God, from this perspective, all of the events that unfold in our lives are a language unto themselves, mirroring back to us what it is that we have spoken. Our husbands, our wives, the relationships that we have with them, our lovers, our friends, our careers, our health, our abundance, all are elements of this language. From this perspective, the world speaks to us in every moment of every day in an ongoing dialogue, a feedback mechanism, describing to us the quality of what it is that we have become from within. And the world does it without judgment.
The world around us, it's not judging us as good, bad, right, or wrong. It simply is an unbiased mirror. And the mirror now, we know, is this highly refined substance, this quantum hologram. It is showing us precisely what it is that we become in our lives. Each experience is the product of thoughts, feelings, and emotions. The pattern that sets into motion all the events that we experience in our lives. It's interesting to me, so interesting, once we understand this principle and these very ancient concepts, we can go back into some of our oldest texts. And I'm not surprised, however, I am constantly in awe of how accurately those who have come before us described precisely these principles over 2,000, 2,500 years, in some cases 3, 4,000 years before our time, how they described precisely these principles. Think about this. What if I invited you to sit down today with a pencil and paper and to describe the relationships that we are developing right now? If I ask you to describe them to a people that you have never met over 3,000 years into your future, how would you do it? What language would you possibly use? How do you know that English is even going to be a language that's used 3,000 years from now? That our language will survive? What language, what words would you use? And when we think about these things from this perspective, I have just so much respect for the ability of those who have come before us to convey these principles. For example, the understanding that the world around us is a mirror of another world, that the world around us is a mirror of what we become from within. And through the ancient language of Hebrew, now we established earlier in the program, that the soul in our bodies and what we call God and what we call consciousness and what we call heaven are all one and the same. That God lives within our bodies. That our soul, God, and heaven are one and the same. You've seen Gospel of Peace from the Unknown Book of the Essenes from Book 2 offers this concept so eloquently in the language of another time. And I invite you to listen to this. It simply says, "My children, know you not that the earth and all that dwells therein is but a reflection of the kingdom of the Heavenly Father. My children, know you not that the earth and all that dwells therein is but a reflection of the kingdom of the Heavenly Father." This passage invites us. It's so powerful and so eloquent. It's telling us that everything that we experience, we know in our world, it is being mirrored by another world. And this is precisely what the principle of vertical time and the quantum hologram is inviting us to consider in the language of Western science. In the earlier part of the 20th century, so many of these concepts were introduced into the West. Many of the things that we're sharing here now that we've developed are very common in Eastern understandings and Eastern traditions. And some of the first places we saw them introduced into the West in the 1950s and the 60s were through practices such as Transcendental Meditation, TM, introduced by the founder, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And one of the statements that he made that was so mystical during those early years of introducing those concepts into our part of the world now makes such tremendous sense. So any TM, Transcendental Meditation people here in the audience? I knew there'd be a few here. TM people have done some wonderful research of the effects of human emotion and states of consciousness in a room and what it means outside of that room. What it means to the communities surrounding those places. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, when he began bringing this information to the West, he made a statement. This is a very sweeping statement, but what it says has a lot of merit. He said, "All occurrences," that's a sweeping statement, "all occurrences of violence, negativity, conflict, crisis, or problems in any society are the expression of stress in the collective consciousness." Remember, stress and tension result in violence and negativity. This is what this theory is saying. Our world, North America, Western society, is a world of fierce competition in academics, in corporations, pressure to succeed, pressure to excel, condone violence. And we all know about this. We've seen it. You've heard research studies about it. Melissa and I did a little experiment recently. We went to a late afternoon, a matinee showing of a first-run movie.
Actually, I've done this twice. One of the times I did it by myself with an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. I was the only gray-haired person in the in the audience. I like Arnold movies. But this particular movie was one where Arnold Schwarzenegger was chasing the bad guys. They ran into an elevator, and the elevator closed, even though part of the bad guys were in the elevator and part were out of the elevator. And then the elevator began to move to another floor, severing limbs that were very graphically falling everywhere. And the kids in the audience just thought that was really cool. It wasn't like they were groaning like, oh. They were groaning and using the word, oh, sweet. Sweet. And I'm just using that as one example. It's happening in many different ways. It's so subtle, and we're so conditioned to it, we may not even recognize it. That is a really horrible thing to see. We heard the same thing. Melissa and I saw the movie Panic Room. Jodie Foster, a wonderful movie. There's a place where something similar happens, where one of the bad guys gets his hand caught in a big iron gate that closes the panic room, and he's in there writhing for like 30 minutes. And the kids in the audience just thought that was really, really great to see. That tells us that there is something, there is a desensitivity. And I know that you know this, we've heard about this. All of those things, however, I'm not saying they're right, wrong, good, or bad. I'm saying those things are going to contribute to stress and tension in the collective consciousness, and it's got to be expressed in some way. That tension comes out in ways we're only beginning to understand. The stress and the tension in the unseen world results in expressions of tensions in our visible world, and violence. We see it locally, maybe in a school shooting. We see it internationally as global tension. We see it expressed as events in our lives that we never thought would happen in our lifetimes. So the question is there something that can happen if we are in fact linked through this field of consciousness, this unified field? There is no them and us. There is a we that means that you and I have access to the fields of that tension, of that consciousness. If tension in our inner world results in that violence, then the flip side is also true. And the studies support this. The studies say the honoring of the diversity of populations, honoring our uniqueness, managing conflict in new ways, finding peace as an industry in our families and corporations is mirrored as peace in our world as well. You can full well expect if we become these things at the dinner table and in our families, in our communities, in our corporations, and as a nation, we can full well expect to see these qualities mirrored back through the quantum hologram in the world around us.
Well, one of the reasons it's so interesting is because modern experiments now support this relationship, and they carry it one step further. What the experiments suggest is that when stress or tension is relieved within a group, in a room, or in a building, or in a community, the effects of relieving that tension are registered beyond that room, beyond that building, or beyond that community. They're registered beyond the immediate group. To demonstrate this point, 1972, 24 cities in the United States, each city with populations over 10,000 people, were chosen for an experiment. What happened in the experiment was that into those cities, individuals were placed who were trained to create very specific kinds of feeling in their bodies. And in those feelings of peace, in the feelings in the absence of stress and tension, when they were all having their experiences simultaneously, here's what happened. What the scientists found was that statistically measurable reductions were noted in crime, in crimes against people, in violent crimes, in major population centers, that statistically measurable reductions in the numbers of emergency hospital room visits were noted, in traffic accidents. And one of the interesting things that happened is one of the cities that was used for this particular study was the city of Chicago. And in Chicago, where the Chicago stock market was in session during the time that the trained individuals were feeling the feelings of peace and the lack of tension, and when all of the other statistics were declining, the Chicago stock market soared in the presence of those experiences. When the practitioners stopped what they were doing, the statistics reversed. And these experiments were conducted again and again and again with all of the conditions in place to make certain that these were not simply coincidences, that what was happening was a predictable, consistent phenomenon. And what the scientists found, the researchers found, that it was so consistent that they could actually develop the numbers for how many people were required in the city to have feelings of reduced tension, to feel those feelings of peace in their bodies within themselves, before the effects were measured and detected in the world around them. So they found that when as few as 1%, in other words, when as few as 100 for every 10,000 people participated, that was what they called the threshold where the effects began to be seen in the communities surrounding where these people were. Obviously, the more people that participated, the more accelerated the effect. Well, this study then was carried even further and led to another study that to me is one of the most significant studies in peace documented in the 20th century. This is the very famous Orme, Johnson, Alexander, Davies, Chandler, Larimore study that was entitled the International Peace Project in the Middle East. It was first published in a journal that is entitled the Journal of Conflict Resolution, and I'll share with you the reference so that you can find this for yourselves. The Journal of Conflict Resolution, Volume 32, Number 4, December 1988, on page 778. And when you go to this article entitled the International Peace Project in the Middle East, you'll read the story of a study, a fascinating study that was conducted during the war between the Israelis and the Lebanese in the early 1980s. And what they found was that in the midst of the terrorist attacks, of the bombings, of the seemingly random killings that were occurring during this time, the principles that were found to be true, to hold true during the studies in 1972, were carried into the Middle East as practitioners trained in feeling the lack of tension and feeling the peace in their lives, trained in traditions of meditation and TM, as they were strategically placed in this part of the Middle East during the time that they were practicing and implementing their practices, the very same kinds of statistics were found to be true. The incidences of violent crimes against people declined. Terrorist activities stopped altogether. Emergency hospital room visits declined. And all kinds of controls were put into place just to make sure that it wasn't a function of lunar cycles or to make sure it wasn't a function of the holy days or a holiday when these things were happening. When the researchers were completed, and what the statistics in the Journal of Conflict Resolution are describing was simply this. They refined the number of people to an even greater degree that is determined to be necessary to hold the feelings of peace in a given population before the population begins to mirror that experience. And I'll share with you what the number is, and then I'll share with you what that number means. The number of people required in a given population for that population to begin to experience the peace and the lack of tension is a very small number. The number is the square root of 1% of the given population. I'll say that again. The square root of 1% of the given population. What does that mean? It means for any population, whether it's 25 people in a room, or 1,000 people in an auditorium, or 10,000 people in a community, or a million people in a city, or 6.2 billion people on the earth, for any population, if you take 1% on your little calculator, take 1% of that number of the population, and then from the number that is 1%, take the square root, and that will tell you the minimum number of people, what's called the threshold number of people that are required to participate in the feelings in their hearts and in their bodies of peace and the relief of stress and tension before those effects are mirrored in a population around them. And the numbers are amazingly small. In a city of approximately 1 million people, for example, the square root of 1% of the population is only about 100 people. In a world of 6 billion people, the square root of 1% is only about 8,000 people. 8,000 people, and that's all it is. I'd like to share with you a story of how this principle is actually implemented in 1998 in a global experiment. It was actually a vigil of prayer. Actually, I participated, another author, Mr. James Twyman, and another author, Doreen Virtue. The three of us participated in organizing through the World Wide Web a vigil where we left the instructions for precisely this modality of feeling, this lost mode of non-denominational prayer, upon a website so that everyone could access it. And they, to some degree, they had the instructions for how to feel the feelings of peace in their hearts rather than asking that peace come to pass in our world. We weren't praying for peace to occur. We weren't asking for peace to happen in any one particular location. We weren't saying, let there be peace in Israel or let there be peace in Africa. We were inviting people throughout the world to simply embrace and embody the feeling of what it feels like and give thanks, gratitude, and appreciation for the peace that already exists in our world. And by virtue of doing that, to open the door for the possibility of greater peace. Well, the vigil was held in the evening. It was about 7 o'clock in the evening, Eastern Standard Time in North America. What we know from the statistics later on is that at least 83 nations participated, and several hundred thousand people on a global basis participated in this prayer. Well, the next day in the newspapers, we saw some amazing things being reported. And one of the most prominent was on the cover of the New York Times as well as the San Francisco Chronicle. There were stories that the evening before, and no one knew that this was happening, this wasn't announced, the evening before, then President Bill Clinton had authorized the United States to begin bombing runs into Iraq, specifically into Baghdad, during that time because of a breakdown in the weapons inspections. So the warplanes left their bases. They were carrying their ordnance, their weapons, and on the way over to their targets, then-President Bill Clinton issued a very rare order, a military term that's called stand down. It was a stand down order that simply said, return to your bases with all of your weapons intact. And what the newspapers were saying was it was a mystery as to why this had happened the way that it happened. It made no sense. The Western nations had spent tremendous amounts of energy and time and money and personnel getting everything in place to go forward with this bombing run. And seemingly, for a reason that appeared miraculous, the planes just turned around and came back. Now, statistically, as a scientist, I cannot say to you that those planes turned around in midair and came back because of a global vigil of peace, on the one hand. And on the other hand, what I can say to you is this. If the correlations are so high, when we see time after time, case history after case history of precisely such events occurring, and the fact that this order was given during the prayer window, it was given during the hour of time, the 1 hour of time when the world was simply feeling the feeling of peace, I think that those statistics are important, and at the very least, we must say there's an effect, and there's an effect worth study and consideration. Because what the studies are showing is that in the presence of peace, all that can happen is peace. In the presence of a field of global peace, that's all that can unfold in our world. I've been with groups as large as 3,200 people where we have invited people in the audience. We've shared with them this information and we've led them through a process where they embody the feeling, not the thought, but the feelings of peace in their hearts. They give thanks of appreciation and gratitude for the peace that already exists in our world. They're not praying for peace to happen somewhere. And then in the experiment, we've had people outside the room who were very angry. And we've invited those angry people to come into the room of 3,200 people and remain angry. And the most interesting thing happens. Because in the experiments that I participate in, where we've done these things, the people will come in from outside of the room and they say it is the strangest, the oddest feeling. Because they walk into the room and in their minds, they're able to think the thoughts of the conditions and the situations for which they have been angry in the past. So the mental image is there. However, they say they cannot get to the feeling of the anger. They simply cannot be angry in that field. And I'm not surprised, because in the presence of peace, I believe all that can happen is peace. You've probably had similar experiences. I know you felt this before. You may be engaged in very animated conversation, or walking down the street, chatting away, meeting with a friend you haven't seen for a long time, and together you walk into a church during a service, and immediately you are no longer animated. Immediately you feel the power of the field created by what is happening in the hearts and minds and people in that church. You're affected by that field. I believe something very similar happened the night of our global prayer vigil. The key to this prayer vigil is that the people throughout the world, for the most part, and admittedly, I mean, there are some people that probably learned to do this better than others. Some people were more serious about it than others. And the point is that many, many people, several hundred thousand people, were participating. They were not praying for peace to occur. Because if you recall the wisdom of my friend David, he said, when you ask for something to happen, what you're saying is it's not already there. So the evening of our prayer vigil, we were not asking for peace to come to our world, and by doing so acknowledging that peace doesn't already exist. What we were doing was simply giving thanks for the peace that we already feel in our hearts, because there's always peace in our world somewhere, and by that way opening the door to greater possibilities of peace. The significance of these studies, and one of the places that was documenting the effects of this kind of study, was Princeton University. Princeton University, there are some brilliant, brilliant researchers, very, very good scientists, and I'm going to really do my very best to honor these gentlemen that are responsible for the research project as scientists and honor the scientific method while I describe the research project that is underway there. Princeton University, in 1998, began a project. This is called the Global Consciousness Project, GCP, an organization called the Boundary Institute. And the thinking behind this project was from two very, very brilliant researchers, Dean Radin and Roger Nelson, are the researchers that are responsible for this project. What they were sensing at the time, the intent behind this project, was if in fact there is a field of consciousness that envelops our world, this global consciousness field, then we may be able to detect this field through very specific kinds of electronics. Now, this is a whole program unto itself, precisely how the operation, the function of electronics are affected by consciousness. Well, what the researchers found is that there is a certain class of electronics that, in fact, is affected by changes in the field of human consciousness. And based on this relationship, they built 40 small devices and installed them throughout the world on different continents, each device reporting, sending a signal back into one computer at Princeton University at the rate of about 200 bits per second, 200 BPS. So in 1998, researchers at Princeton, they installed these 40 devices throughout the world. Each of the 40 devices is sending a signal back into one computer, a server, at the Boundary Institute at Princeton University. And the idea was, in 1998, that if we were ever going to detect a shift in consciousness, boy, the time to do it would be during the change in the millennium. Because during the millennium, the entire world was in celebration. We survived another 100 years. We survived another 1,000 years together. And they said if we were ever going to detect a fluctuation or a change in this field of consciousness, as the dateline swept across the nations of the earth, and one by one, those nations and entire geographic areas and continents along the time zones began to celebrate, that's when we should be able to pick up these changes in consciousness. So the devices were installed in 1998. They were tested. They were in place. They appeared to work very well. The millennium came along, and they worked like a champ. As the dateline swept across the earth, what they found was that there were very significant changes in consciousness time after time after time. The electronics were affected by the shift in the excitement of the celebration. And these fields, they shift in response to good things and bad things. Super Bowls, the death of Princess Diana, the funeral, television programs where everyone was tuned in all at once to watch these kinds of things. And one of the reasons I'm sharing this with you now is because the Global Consciousness Project was online when we conducted our prayer vigil in 1998. And we were in phone contact with them, members of the organization that I was working with. And what the researchers said was, we just saw a blip. We saw a blip in global consciousness. What are you guys doing? And what the researcher said is, we invited the world to have a prayer. And this is where I have to be very, very careful, because Dean Radin and Roger Nelson, they are very good scientists, very good researchers, and they're the first to say that we do not understand precisely why this effect is occurring. We are not even certain precisely what it is that's being measured, on the one hand. On the other hand, however, there appears to be an effect, and the effect is worth studying, and the effect works well enough that we can, maybe, from my perspective, that we can apply what we do know to understand how this field works in our lives. Well, now I'd like to share a very interesting footnote to the study of the Global Consciousness Project, because once the 40 devices were put into place, they remain in place. They're there today, to the best of my knowledge, right now. They're humming away, sending information back to the Boundary Institute at Princeton University. Well, they were there during September 11th, 2001. And what the researchers began doing was, after the events, after the dust had settled and the events subsided, researchers went back to look at the data to see what had happened. And what they found surprised even the researchers who had developed the project, because the implications of what I'm about to share with you. What they found was that on an average day, when humankind, human consciousness, is just doing what it always does, when we're going about our day, we're doing our errands, we're going to the mall, to the grocery stores, we're going to work, we're shopping, we're driving on the freeways, we're with our families, the readings for human consciousness are at a certain level on a graph, and they're just kind of evenly humming away during that time. Well, on 9/11, those readings elevated tremendously. They were right off the chart, and that was precisely what was expected, because so much of the world, consciousness was focused all over the world on these events. The surprising part, what was not expected, is this, that almost a full day and a half before the events of 9/11 ever occurred, a full day and a half before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the plane crashes ever occurred, in our reality, the 40 devices began picking up anomalous readings in human consciousness, and readings that continued to increase and elevate from midway through September 9th all the way along the day of September the 10th, peaking on September 11th, and then dropping back again the 12th and the 13th afterward. Now, what the scientists that I've spoken with, Dean Radin, Roger Nelson, what they're saying is, we do not know precisely what these readings say. We don't know precisely what they're saying to us. And I'm honoring the work and the interpretations of the Boundary Institute. At the same time, obviously there is an effect. Obviously, on some level, global consciousness was experiencing some form of tension, and maybe not on a conscious level, may have been on an unconscious level. It was unconscious to us, on the one hand. The other hand, the devices were picking it up. On some level, maybe we knew that something was up almost a full day and a half before it ever occurred. And it's interesting, the stories that we heard afterward, the number of people, as tragic as the day was, and as many lives as there were lost, there is a general agreement that the tragedies could have been much greater, and even more lives could have been lost. However, there were an anomalous number of people, seemingly anomalous number, that altered their patterns of activities on that day for unexplained reasons. People woke up in the morning intending to go to work, and on the way to work, suddenly they said, you know, this is the day I think I'm going to go visit my mother and my father, maybe take them to the store this morning on the way into work. Or maybe this is a day I'm going to take this day off and stay home with my family, take my kids to the park. There were people that had planned to fly on the commuter planes that day that did not, and at the last minute canceled and changed their plans. Why did these things happen? Scientifically, we cannot say for certain precisely why these things happen. What we can say is the correlations are very, very high. Perhaps on a subconscious cue, we knew through the field of energy that links all of creation, through this field that the Global Consciousness Project is using with these little devices to pick up fluctuations in consciousness, through the stuff that's called the mind of God, perhaps we knew on some level that something was up. And even if we didn't acknowledge it consciously, we responded. Some individuals responded by changing the patterns of their daily lives. It's interesting. It's interesting to think about. The field obviously requires additional study. What we do know is this. We know that in every moment of every day, we're having feelings. And that the lost mode of prayer is reminding us that those feelings are a prayer. So that every moment of every day, as we said earlier, is in fact a prayer. What we feel in our hearts is a command, literally a command in the mind of God. Because the mind of God interprets our feelings very literally. Very literally. So my question to you right now is, do you know what you're feeling? What if everything you felt in your heart became the reality of your world? What if everything you felt in your heart became a command to the mind of God? How differently would you live every day? For example, would you make the extra effort maybe to help someone else's life be a little easier? Would you acknowledge them in ways that perhaps you had not in the past? In 1998, I was with a group on our way into Tibet. And before we reached Tibet, we were acclimating to the elevation and having orientations in the country of Nepal, specifically in the city of Kathmandu. Part of our acclimation there, I wanted to invite people into some of the temples and the sacred sites, some of the earliest known sites in the Hindu traditions. And in these places, we had the opportunity to be around huge groups of locals, the native peoples who were there. And one of these areas was called the Barkur Square, just a beautiful area inside of Kathmandu. And as we were with our group, and we had a translator and a guide that was describing to us the history of the square and the architecture of some of the buildings, and the crowds of locals were so thick they were pressing against us physically. I mean, we were confined into a very small space. And I kept feeling a tug at the pleat on my cotton pants. And at first I ignored it because it was so subtle. And then it happened again, and I couldn't look away, and I looked down, and I wasn't prepared for what I saw. As I looked down, I was looking into the eyes of a very dark-skinned, very intense man who was just about knee level to where I was standing. He had long, silvery wisps of hair that were blowing across his face with the hot wind that was blowing across the square. And he took me by surprise. And as I glanced down below his body to the place where his legs should have been, all that was there was an old wooden board, rounded on the edges from years of use and wear. It was on wheels, and this apparently was his only means of locomotion. The man was naked except for a loincloth that covered him from the waist, and that loincloth was draped down onto this board. He apparently had no legs, and this was his only means of getting around. And I immediately assumed that he was a beggar, that he was asking me for a handout. And I reached into my pocket to give him whatever Nepalese money that I had. In my judgment of this man and what I thought that he wanted from me. And what he did surprised me. He motioned away from me with his hand. He didn't want my money. He actually refused to have any money that I was trying to hand to him. And he simply turned around and he pointed up to a very beautiful building. It was a building that I hadn't seen before. We'd missed it when we walked into the square for some reason. And I looked at this building, and it was just a beautiful building that was set back with a facade. The front of the building, rather than being solid facade, it was made of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tiny figurines in the image of Hindu gods, all intricately carved in what appeared to be an ebony or a mahogany wood. And I looked up, and I was in awe. The building was so beautiful, I wondered how I had missed it. And I looked down to thank the man, and he was gone. There wasn't a man there. And my eyes darted through the crowd, and I began searching to see if I could find where he was, and suddenly the people parted, and I saw his back as he was moving away from me. On his board, he was scooting over to the other side of the Barcourse Square. And I thought about going after him and thanking him for what he had shared with me. And I had a feeling that he had done what he came to do, and that by me looking at what he had shown me, that our relationship was complete. And it dawned on me what this man looked for. He wasn't looking for a handout, and he wasn't a beggar looking for money. He simply wanted to share with me the beauty of his land through his eyes and from his perspective, and he wanted to be acknowledged. And in that acknowledgement, when I acknowledged him and we had our interaction, I felt that that was the completion of our time together. And I'm sharing the story now because I thought about that man a lot throughout that trip. And the interesting thing was, although our relationship lasted only a matter of a couple of moments, and then he was gone, what I found was that I missed him when I didn't see him. And I thought about him throughout the trip. And I thought about how different my world would be if I had not met that man on that day, and how different my world would be if I didn't know he was there. I'm sharing this now to invite you to look into the world around you and look at the people that you might judge, the people that are crossing the street in the crosswalk as you wait at the light, safe in your vehicle, and the thoughts that you have about them and the way you may judge them as being fat or skinny or tall or short or beautiful or something other than beautiful. What you think about the tattoos and the piercings, or what you think about the way they're dressed, and then think how empty your world would be if you had not just had that experience, how much you would miss those people. And from this perspective, when we begin to become very conscious of the uniqueness that everyone brings to our lives and how very special every experience really is, we begin, I believe, to really grasp what it means to live each moment of each day and know that those moments are prayers, and that we are in constant communication with the world around us. It's an invitation for us to give thanks of gratitude and appreciation for the beauty and the uniqueness, even the strange things that we don't always understand or agree with, because that's what brings the beauty to our world that makes us who we are today.